riddles on Dixie cups, fortune cookies, novelty t-shirts, and seafood restaurant placemats. Boredom's gonna be your greatest enemy, so make your own fun. Time was a family could get a wonderful evening out of some sheet music and an egg timer. Bonus, you'll be an empty nester years earlier than your friends. Switch to Christian entertainment. For every corrupt Hollywood influence, there's a life-affirming Christian equivalent. For instance, instead of rotting my mind with the mindless violence of a game like Grand Theft Auto, I play Left Behind Eternal Forces. That way, I know every enemy I kill goes directly to hell. Write letters. Let the child poisoners know you're keeping an eye on them. Write them emails on an hourly basis to tell them how offensive you find the movies you're not seeing. It's amazing how easy it is to make "I'm praying for you" sound like a threat. Go camping. Drop off the grid and get away from the corroding influences of the debased culture and return to nature, preferably to Idaho with a group of like-minded patriots, their child brides, and a cache of weapons. You never know when alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is going to show up and try to make you watch Capote. If all else fails, pull the old switcheroo. Consume everything. Totally immerse yourself in the filth of pop culture to build a callus on your soul. It's like when my dad caught me with cigarettes when I was 12 and forced me to finish an entire carton of Cools. Worked like a charm. I have not smoked a menthol since. And now, Mort Sinclair, former TV comedy writer, communist.
Here's a joke for you. A man walks into a bar. Bartender says, "What'll it be, Mac?" The man looks at the drink menu and says, "How about a revolution of the proletariat?" Zing! Wrote that one for Dinah Shore back in 1954. You see, I used to be a comedy writer. And like many comedians during the 1950s, there was nothing I wanted more than to use my jokes to overthrow the government and replace it with a classless communist society. It all started when I was a kid. I remember sitting in the movie House watching The Three Stooges, hearing everyone laugh and thinking to myself, I know what I want to do. Undermine the capitalist system and replace it with collective farms. Quick! A man and his wife are lying in bed. The wife says, "Honey, why don't you roll over here and kiss me?" The man says, "I would, but I'm shackled by my capitalist oppressors." Ha-cha-cha-bang! First job interview I had was with Milton Berle. I'll never forget what he said to me after reading my joke packet. "Good material, kid. But I think you can inject more references to the industrial class structure." And he was right. Only three of my jokes mentioned the evils of private ownership. That's comedy gold. To me, the perfect joke didn't end with a laugh, but with an agonizing reappraisal of the workers' suppression by the entrenched plutocrats. It's funny, because it's true. Of course, my career as a TV comedy writer wasn't always easy, but whenever things got rough, I'd remind myself that if my jokes got just one person to sell nuclear secrets to the Russians, then it was well worth it. I'll leave you with this joke I wrote for Sid Caesar. "President Truman is like communist ideology, no class." Z-z-z-bang!
Part 3. My American maturity. In 1997, I was made the anchor of the Channel 7 News at Noon on WPTS Patterson Springs, North Carolina. I got promoted after I narked out the previous anchor, Wayne Colt, for his coke addiction and won a local Emmy for my investigative report, "Anchor Away, the Tragic Downward Spiral of Wayne Colt." I was getting too big for Patterson Springs, population 620, so that fall I sent out a reel of my best reports. From Wayne to Worse, the Continuing Struggles of Wayne Colt. Wayne Damage, the hidden camera footage Wayne Colt begged me not to show you. Wayne, Go Away, living in fear of a former colleague. And Never the Wayne Shall Meet, my restraining order against Wayne Colt, coke fiend. I immediately got a call from The Daily Show. I had made it to the big time, so I moved to the big city and I bought the big house. Now I had real responsibilities. If something goes wrong with your house, it's your problem, buddy. And boy, can things go haywire. There's electricity and fuse boxes and three-prong outlets. It's like living in the space station. No one warned me that life would involve science, except my science teacher. But of course he's going to say that. He's got his job to protect. 4 months after moving in, I noticed that the yard looked terrible. When we did the final walkthrough, the lawn was beautiful. Now the grass was waist-high and shaggy. Had I been sold a bill of goods? I faced the problem like a man. I called my lawyer, who called a landscaper. Now, I knew a lot of yard guys were illegal immigrants, blue-collar banditos, stealing manual labor jobs away from Americans who had moved on to something less strenuous. So I let them do the lawn, and then I asked to see their green cards. They didn't have any, so I went inside and called INS. When Los Federales rolled up, I shouted from the window, "Enjoy mowing Mexico!" It was an ugly scene. Turns out they didn't have green cards because they were all Americans. In fact, African Americans. I explained that I don't see race. On that subject, I am very enlightened and equally endarkened. Eventually, everything was smoothed over with some sizable tips to the landscapers and even more sizable tips to the cops. Now, I tell this story to illustrate the issues we all face as American adults. I call them the four S's and one M of adulthood: socioeconomics, segregation, science, sombreros, and the media. Chapter 10, The Media. The greatest threat facing America today, next to voter fraud, the Western pine bark beetle, and the memory foam mattress, is the national news media. Simple question with a yes answer. Is the mainstream press too liberal? Yes. Of course, there are a few journalists who aren't registered sex offenders. These people all work for Fox News. Now, I have a well-cured beef with Fox. Fair and balanced? Which is it, fellas? Make up your mind. I'm sure guys like Britt Hume and Sean Hannity are well-intentioned, but by trying to present both sides of each story, they're suggesting that the truth exists somewhere in the middle. You know what's really in the middle? The gray area. Shades of gray are for brain tissue and the weak. Neither one has a place in the news business. I like my truth, like my coffee, black or white. See, if I die, I know I'm either going to heaven or hell. There's no gray area there. For the record, heaven. These are the top mainstream media news outfits that are killing our children. 1. NPR. What's wrong with NPR? Just listen to Morning Edition. This is by far the least zany morning zoo ever to hit the airwaves. Instead of the get-up-and-go-larity provided by your local Scott and Tom, or Ted and Zeke, or Denise and Santana, or Coyote Mike and the Beamer, Morning Edition presents NPR's measured barbiturate vibe. It's a wonder the lefties who wake up to it are able to get out of bed. I guarantee that if Morning Edition had to compete in the free market, you'd hear a lot more prank phone calls to the Supreme Court asking if that's a gavel in their docket. Second threat, the big three networks. CBS. The Tiffany Network is responsible for the perennial Sunday night post-game buzzkill 60 Minutes. And Morley Safer and his team of aged jackals present what I believe is the worst kind of investigative journalism, the kind with investigations. On the other hand, I like the innovations that Katie Couric has brought to the CBS Evening News, especially the innovation of having people not watch it. NBC. A lot of people make the mistake of getting their nightly newscast from Brian Williams when the real star of the Peacock News division is the Law and Order franchise. All the plots are ripped from today's headlines. ABC. When Charlie Gibson took over the evening news anchor chair, I doubted he had the heft for the job. But those fears were put to ease once I learned that he had changed his name to Charles Gibson. As for ABC's liberal bias, the jury's still out. Jury's back in. Guilty. Threat number 3, C-SPAN. C-SPAN's liberal bias is severely underestimated. With its unvarnished gavel-to-gavel coverage of our elected leaders, C-SPAN glamorizes big government by showing not only how it works, but that it sometimes does work. C-SPAN 2 may be just as dangerous, but it has never been watched. Threat number 3, or 4, I don't care. The New York Times. One of the few downsides to my job is that I have to read the New York Times every day. Why? Well, to quote my old friend Wesley Snipes, "Know thine enemy." I do this dirty work as a service to my viewers, as the Times cornucopia of bias and lies provides an endless source of things for me to be outraged about. An outrage is what makes me go. I call it the juice, because like steroids, the New York Times fills you with rage and shrinks your genitalia. And get this, there isn't even a comics page in the New York Times. I think that says all anyone needs to know about the somber gray lady. Evidently, the Ox and the Sulzbergers and the Dowds and the Krugmans think they're above it all. They look down on regular folks like you and me who delight at Garfield's lasagna-fueled catitude. So I'm forced to fashion my own grin bin by making up funny captions to photos in the international section. But there is a light at the end of the tunnel vision. Over the past few years, the internets has grown from a haven for pornography and pet anecdotes into a haven for pornography and pet anecdotes where people go for news. The source-checking, story-verifying, reality-worshipping dinosaurs of the mainstream media are being pushed aside by the emergent tree shrews of the blogosphere. Do I have any hard data to back these claims up? No. But the beauty of new media is that no evidence is necessary. The brave blog troopers have stormed the cockpit of news and wrested the joystick of authority away from the seasoned pilots of the press who would land our country at Facts International Airport. Now there's fresh blood at the controls, without any of the preconceived notions of the rudder and flaps crowd. This is the age of the open-source encyclopedia. Words like research and corroborated now mean whatever the majority says they mean. Personally, I'm voting for research to mean speculation and corroborated to mean a zesty sour cream-based dip. Example. Recent research indicates that Barack Obama's ties to Al-Qaeda have been corroborated, and they are delicious on baby carrots. But if you ask me, and you implicitly did ask me by buying this CD, the digital bloom may soon be off the virtual rose. These days, even Wolf Blitzer covers blogs on his show, and the first thing every journalist learns is the 5 W's of journalism. Who, what, when, where, and Wolf Blitzer is for hospital patients and old people. Chapter 11. Class War. Tales from the Heart. Let me tell you a little story. Growing up, I lived in a classic American neighborhood. It was a melting pot of hard-working Irish, British, English, Scottish, Scots-Irish, Welsh, and Northern Irish. Each morning, my pop would rise at the crack of dawn and walk a mile to pretend he was going to the store to pick up our breakfast. In the winter months, he would chop down a neighbor's woodshed so we would have fuel to burn. When he got home, he would polish our shoes. If we couldn't afford shoes, he'd polish our feet. Then he'd send us off to school with sack lunches of pine cones and salt. Once he knew we were taken care of, he'd leave for his job working for the local rich guy. All day in class, I would think about what my dad did for us, how hard he worked, and that I never wanted to do any of that. I wanted to be the local rich guy. Today, I am. Reality check. What's the point of my little story? Through clean living, moral fortitude, and the foresight to narc out Channel 7's coke-addicted news anchor Wayne Colt, and then take his job and win a regional Emmy for my coverage of his downward spiral, I changed my class status. That's right, folks. I'm talking about class. What is class? Well, class is a way of looking at society that divides people into different categories based on how much money they're willing to make. Every society has its own class structure with a unique number of classes. France has 5. Les aristocrates, les bourgeoisies, les petits déjeuners, les grands mâles, and les mauvaises. India has the most rigid and complex class structures. Based upon their behavior in past lives, all Indians are born into different strata of society called castes. These castes forever determine what level of tech support questions they are allowed to answer. We in America have 3 classes, upper, middle, and lower. When I was growing up, we were in the lower, and today, I'm in the upper. You want to change your class? Here's how. As a pundit, it's my job to fight for the little guy. And in terms of the percentage of population, that means the upper class. But all Americans are important to me. I won't be satisfied until everyone is in the top 1%. You see, we're lucky here in America. We live in a free market society. Think of it as a ladder. No matter what rung you're born on, you have the exact same opportunity as everyone else to get to the top. Sure, you might say that some folks have less distance to climb than others, or that many of the lower rungs are slippery because they're covered with garbage, and your high school didn't have an AP ladder climbing class, and the rung right above you is out of order, and your landlord keeps saying he's going to fix it, but he never does, And all the while, the guy who hangs out on the corner of your rung is constantly trying to get you high. And you're wondering if maybe you could get a little help up this ladder. Well, mister, all the help you need is at your fingertips, if your fingertips are touching your ankles. I'm talking about bootstraps. You can always pull yourself up by your bootstraps or turn the lemons life has given you into lemonade. You see, America has no shortage of metaphorical opportunities for the poor. But some people would just rather stay poor just to make us feel guilty. Well, don't look for any sympathy here. Instead of getting rich and paying their own way, they'd rather go on welfare, and the liberals are more than happy to give it to them. Now, I'm not the smartest knife in the spoon, so explain this to me. We're supposed to help folks out of poverty by giving them a financial reward for being poor? That doesn't add up. If being poor is such a never-ending money party, where's the incentive to get rich? Now, some people might say it's callous not giving food stamps to poor people. They say it's just another example of class warfare. Well, there is no class warfare in this country, folks. The upper class has such a tactical advantage that if the lower class makes a sudden move, we will have a class massacre or classicre. If you ask me, the upper class shows admirable restraint. They could easily freeze out the poor and man their factories with robots or mice. Instead, they offer them the opportunity for a decent wage and up to 2 bathroom breaks. But do folks in the lower classes respond with even a simple gesture of gratitude, like giving up a decent wage and one of those bathroom breaks? No. Instead, they form unions, which they use to bully our nation's factory owners with walkouts, strikes, and that one Sally Field movie where she plays a labor organizer with 16 personalities. Quick quiz. Are you a union member? Answer yes or no. Thank you for taking my quick quiz. If you answered yes, know that I could have you replaced with a single phone call. There are hundreds of scabs out there who can listen to my book just as well as you can. Don't tempt me. Another quick quiz. Will you tempt me? Answer yes or no. I trust you made the right choice. Now let me tell you about a little tidbit I found in the Chicago Tribune. It seems some environmental group, the Ecology Center, is claiming that the new car smell we all crave is actually a deadly cocktail of chemical pollutants. Headline, that new car smell may be newest hazard. Quote, of primary concern are bromine used for flame retardants, chlorine used in plasticizers, and lead used in plastics, as well as arsenic, copper, mercury, and nickel that have been linked to allergies, birth defects, impaired learning, liver toxicity, and cancer. Now, at first, I thought this was just another buzz-shackle attempt by the envious hippie nut jobs who can't afford a new car every season because chaining yourself to a maple tree doesn't pay what it used to in the 60s. But then it hit me. Something more insidious was going on here. Who spends a lot of time breathing in that new car smell? The upper class. Who's loading those cars up with the toxic chemicals? Factory workers. The lower class. So, are we in a class war? I don't know. But if we are, it's pretty clear who just fired the first shot. Here's a surprising admission. Sometimes I envy the folks in the lower classes. Like the kid I was pretending to be in that story I made up at the beginning of this chapter. They have so much to look forward to. Their bootstraps are so loose and fit for pulling. Mine can't go any tighter. I'm losing circulation as it is. But poor people have a very precious gift. Something to strive for. But I've got nothing left to reach for because I've been so successful at everything I've put my hands on. Sometimes I can't think of a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Luckily for me, I have a motorized bed. I like to drive it down to the rough side of town and give people in the streets inspiration to work harder. And now, here's someone very special who agrees with what I think. Thomas Bindlestaff, my humble servant.
I am living proof that the American dream is possible. Upward mobility exists in this land of opportunity. My job is to make typewritten copies of all of Mr. Colbert's personal correspondence. Unfortunately, my typewriter keyboard is missing the lowercase letter P. As you might think, this would prove challenging. Fortunately, Mr. Colbert rarely uses lowercase letter P's, and when he does, I simply remove the sheet of paper from the typewriter, reinsert the sheet of paper upside down, type a lowercase D, remove it again, reinsert it right side up, and then proceed as I had been proceeding previously, despite my painful and persistent penman's gout. As I was saying, I'm moving up. Already I make nearly $18,000 a year. And sooner or later, sooner I dearly hope, I shall be the family's first self-made 20,000-aire. In Colbert bucks, that is. Like all Mr. Colbert's employees, my salary is paid in company scrip. Mr. Colbert has thoughtfully provided a company store with a variety of fine dry goods. It has all the essentials. Flour, salt, cornmeal, rendered beef tallow, ticking, and burlap. My wife has her eye on a tin of baking powder. The ladies do love to dream. Oh, there's the whistle. Is it dawn already? I must get started on Mr. Colbert's correspondence. His representative may be in today. I need to make a good impression. I'm hoping to get my youngest a position with the firm, removing debris from the hydraulic ramshaft. Only the wee ones will fit. Note to self, cut back on his ration of suet. Mark my words. I swear by the curvature of my spine, someday I shall be rich. Your humble servant, Thomas Bindlestaff.
Chapter 12. Race. Remember that song Ebony and Ivory by Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney? It's all about how pianos have both black keys and white keys, but the keys don't fight with each other. They just play together in harmony. With a little imagination, the lyrics can also act as a metaphor for race. You see, the white keys could represent white people, and the black keys could represent non-white people. Because in America, people of all colors live in perfect harmony, just like on the piano. But it hasn't always been that way. Once upon a time, racism was a terrible problem in this country, and it's still a subject you're supposed to handle delicately. Sorry, folks, that's not my style. I'm not afraid to disturb the skeletons in America's closet, no matter what race those skeletons are. You can tell by measuring the eye teeth. I'm going to talk about race, and I'm not taking any racial prisoners. So where did racism come from? Well, before the Civil War, skin color didn't matter because all black people were slaves. But then, after they were freed, the name slave didn't really fit them anymore, so former slaves started calling themselves black or negro or colored. In short, skin began to matter, and folks, racism was off to the races. Suddenly, the world was divided. White people had their drinking fountains, black people had their drinking fountains, white people had their schools, black people had their drinking fountains. After about 100 years of this, a very smart man named Dr. the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. gave a speech, and he said, "I have a dream that this should end." And it did. Racism no longer existed in America. Don't believe me? Well, down in Selma, Alabama, they recently opened the National Civil Rights Museum. It's all about the fight against racism. Well, folks, it stands to reason that you don't open a museum for something that still exists. Case in point, Air and Space Museum. Once we landed on the moon, air and space was over. Scotchgard Neil Armstrong and hang him from the ceiling. But even though racism is over, for many people, sadly, race still exists. And as long as any part of that word still lingers, we're all in trouble. So how do we erase race? Let me tell you how I did it. Newsflash. I don't see race. This just in. I used to see race. Caught your breath yet? I'll say it again. I used to see race. In fact, I used to see it everywhere. I was really good at it, if I'm to believe what people shouted at me. But all that changed the day I read Ralph Ellison's thought-provoking novel, The Invisible Man. I found myself deeply moved by his tale of a black scientist who, through no fault of his own, becomes invisible and is driven mad. Reading Invisible Man made me realize something very important. If you're invisible, it means you're the same color as air, and air has no color. Then it hit me. If race is no longer to divide us, our races all need to be invisible. So maybe until that great day when all humans can't see color, those with darker skin should take the Invisible Man's brave example and wrap themselves in the white bandages of unity so that we all truly look the same color. You see, white people are already wrapped in bandages, the skin God gave us to protect us from racism. people of all colors deserve no less. Because we're all the same. Unfortunately, not everyone sees that. They get too hung up on things like appearance and history and cultural identity. In fact, some people seem to think racism still exists. Well, these people are racists. What's their angle? I say follow the money. They have something to gain from keeping the race game afloat. What is it? Two words, affirmative and action. Affirmative action is a prime example of the leftist campaign to make ideas seem less dangerous than they are through the strategic use of positive words. Think about it. How can something be bad if it's affirmative? And how can we ignore it if it's action? You see, its name does nothing to describe what affirmative action actually is, a system that rewards Group A and punishes Group B just because long ago something bad happened to Group A that incidentally made Group B a whole lot of money. One of my mottos is, never make a decision because you feel guilty. My second motto is, never make a decision. My third is, never feel guilty. The bleeding hearts that came up with affirmative action back in the Anything Goes 60s could have used my advice. They felt guilty about the racial injustices of the past, so they decided to make some crazy law that gave minorities preferential treatment when it came to the choicest jobs, scholarships, and roster spots on the NBA teams. The worst thing about affirmative action is that it encourages reverse discrimination, so-called because it goes in the opposite way of how we naturally discriminate. Here's a typical story. A well-qualified young white man doesn't get into the college of his choice, but he has a strong suspicion that a lot of black guys might have. It gets worse, folks. A hard-working white employee is passed over for a promotion in favor of a coworker who seems like he could be gay. What's next? Should there be affirmative action in my bedroom? Should Chinese guys get a shot at my wife just because the conditions on the Transcontinental Railroad weren't ideal? Coolie it off! But the worst thing about affirmative action is that it's big government intruding into the world of business. I don't need some bureaucrat telling me to be an equal opportunity employer. When it comes to job applicants at the rapport, race is irrelevant. All they have to do is answer a skill testing questionnaire. Sample question. We're shooting an episode of the Colbert Report at the beach. It's a very sunny day. What number SPF sunblock do you use? Support your answer. When it comes to affirmative action, I quote myself, hogwash. However, most people quote noted beagle abuser President Lyndon Johnson, who summed up his stance on the issue with the following analogy. Quote, imagine a 100-yard dash in which one of the two runners had his legs shackled together. He has progressed 10 yards. While the unshackled runner has gone 50 yards. How do we rectify the situation? Do they merely remove the shackles and allow the race to proceed? Would it not be the better part of justice to allow the previously shackled runner to make up the 40-yard gap, or to start the race all over again? Johnson was right on one point. Racial issues in this country deserve the same amount of attention we give track and field events. While Johnson's idea was terrible for public policy, he stumbled upon what I think would be a great improvement for track and field. Shackles. How exciting would it be to give each runner a unique, massive obstacle to overcome? Here's how I see the 100-yard dash of tomorrow. Lane 1, a shackled runner. Lane 2, a runner forced to wear a sandwich board. Lane 3, a runner in ice skates. Lane 4, the runner must run backward holding a hand mirror. Lane 5, the runner's pockets are filled with sausages with a pack of wild, angry dogs released onto the field. Lane 6, the runner has bare feet on a lane of wet bathroom tile responsible for 80% of household fatalities. Lane 7, the runner is given horrible news moments before the start. I mean, really bad. Your grandmother's on fire. Go. Lane 8, a death row inmate running on his knees. If he wins, he's freed. And now it's time for another Stephen Speaks for Me. The Reverend George A. Lewis, ex-civil rights leader.
Shouted from the loftiest mountaintops and through the deepest valleys, racism is no more. Bigotry, that grim hydra which once reared its heads in every corner of our proud society, infecting all Americans with its venomous bite, bigotry has been vanquished. And I've done my part to slay it. I marched on Washington shoulder to shoulder with Dr. King. I labored alongside Reverend Jackson in Chicago. I was instrumental in bringing integration to the University of Alabama. And thanks in part to my actions, racism gave way to equality, oppression to justice, and segregation to brotherhood. But as justice rose like a mighty tide from the Mississippi Delta to the highest corridors of power, my own sense of purpose receded. For what is a civil rights leader to do once civil rights have been permanently achieved? For a while, I returned to full-time reverending, but being a preacher is hard work. And let's face it, without racism to rail against, my sermons didn't have the same zazz. So I left my church and sought new causes to champion. I tried marching alongside another oppressed group, the homosexuals. But then I found out what they did when they weren't marching. Other protests proved no better fit. I couldn't in good conscience join the No Nukes movement because I'm a firm believer in America's nuclear first strike capabilities. And I'd rather not recount the lack of appetite for political change at the St. Patrick's Day parade. After that, I flailed around a bit. I remained committed to the principles of nonviolence, but I adapted it to the new injustices I encountered in the new post-racist world. I organized a sit-in to protest unfair practices of a local restaurant. $13 for a spicy tuna roll. Good God Almighty! But it failed to achieve change. I grew isolated and disconsolate. And as painful as it is to admit, in the depths of my despair, I once tried to reintroduce racism. But those Korean grocers wouldn't rise to my bait. As of this writing, I am unemployed. And let me tell you, the pension benefits offered by the civil rights movement are meager at best. I'm currently available to fight for the downtrodden, freelance mass rallying, and light roof repair. In the words of Dr. King, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. If only he had known the cost.
Chapter postscript. Just to be clear, when I say I don't see race, I mean I don't see black people. But I can spot a Mexican at 100 paces. Listen on. Chapter 13, Immigrants. Here's the good news. You won't need any documentation to get into my opinions on immigration, because through the very act of buying this audiobook, your identity has been electronically entered into a secret government registry. The bad news. Folks, we are being colonized by an invading force. Did you know there are more illegal Mexican immigrants in America today than there were American troops in occupied Germany after World War II? Unlike most of my facts, I can back that one up with reality. Experts say there are 12 to 14 million illegal immigrants in the United States. Put that in perspective. If you took all the foreigners who have no business living in America and put them into Dodge Caravans, remember those seat six, and drove them out of the country, taking up all three lanes of a highway, the line of minivans would stretch for I don't care how long, because the more important question is, how can we get them into those vans? So do we have a problem with illegals? I'll say. Now, a lot of people, including my spell check, have a problem with the term illegals. They say it's not a word. And even if it were, it would be insensitive to the feelings of people who are breaking our nation's law. Fine, let's call them immorals, because what could be more immoral than a Guatemalan crossing into this country to pick our American fruit just because her kids are poor? Oh, I can hear the cries now. How can you suggest that we slam the door? America is a nation of immigrants. We all have ancestors who left their crowded, impoverished homelands behind for America. Even Andrew Carnegie was an immigrant. Well, it's interesting that you should bring up Andrew Carnegie, one of our nation's most esteemed robber barons. Yes, he was born in Scotland, so what makes him different from the type of immorals we're experiencing today? Uncover your ears and listen, America. Once upon a time, there was the right kind of foreigner. Yes, Virginia, there is a right kind of foreigner. The kind who comes to America, loses his brogue, and creates U.S. Steel. When he dies, he leaves the legacy of breaking the homestead strike of 1892, paving the road for non-union workers everywhere. If he admits to any foreign ties, it's just to having a hunting estate at Skilbo Castle in Scotland. That's it. No parades, No crazy hat dances. His only clubs are ones like the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, whose man-made trout-stuffed lake burst through its dam, leaving 2,200 dead in one of the greatest floods in American history, the Johnstown Flood of 1889. Sad event, but a great social club. Over 60 millionaires, and that was back when trolley rides cost a penny. Of course, we can't all be Andrew Carnegies, but we can honor the struggles and ambitions of our immigrant ancestors by doing as they did, leaving the past behind for the sake of a brighter future. Listen to my struggle. I'm a member of a mixed-race marriage. While I'm the proud product of hearty Irish Catholic stock, my wife is Scots Presbyterian. In the old country, our love could never have been. In fact, a glance at my wife's family record shows that her ancestors moved on to the very land my family was forced to abandon when that roundhead son of a bitch, Oliver Cromwell, forced the Irish west of the River Shannon to farm rocks. But when the Colbert clan set sail for America, they harbored two shining hopes. One, that they could survive a 3-month steerage passage on coal and onion peel soup. And two, that one day their children could forget the enmity of the past and live a life of freedom. Well, I've done them one better. 7 generations on, I've planted my Irish potato on the very family that stole our land. You see, the great thing about my marriage is that it symbolizes the hope America once offered its immigrants. Here, immigrants received a gift never given before in world history. They could leave the past behind. How lucky they were to get to erase all remnants of their previous lives, languages, and cultures, and go about the business of becoming an American Christian. So let's take that beautiful idea to its logical conclusion and not only leave the past behind, but deny the past ever happened. It's this easy. America is not a land of immigrants. There. Was that so hard to say? It makes sense if you think about it. It feels like we've been here forever, doesn't it? Let's just assume we have been. How does it taste to smash the shackles of our past? Well, to me, it tastes like freedom. Now that we've liberated ourselves from the old factual myth of our immigrant history, we can focus on the future. And let me tell you, there are some dark times ahead, because for the first time in our new history, we are being swarmed by legions of immigrants. And folks, it is time to fight back. We all know the government has refused to take action to end the problem. It's up to us. There are 3 things we can do to secure the borders today. 1. Heavily arm our volunteer militias. The failure of leadership in Washington has given rise to a new border patrol of selfless patriots called the Minutemen. I've hung out with these guys, and let me assure you, they take their duties deadly seriously. Let me also assure you that night vision goggles are cool. Get a pair. 2. Take a lesson from the Chinese. We need to build a 2,000-mile-long wall along our southern border. This will have 2 benefits. First of all, when I'm worried, I like to stay busy. Building a giant wall is a great way to keep the nation's mind off how many immigrants enter the country through airports. 2, this wall might actually keep people out if it's built right. Not like that picket fence the Russians threw up across Berlin. We don't want these Mexican jumping beans hopping over whenever they feel like it. Make it tall. I mean tall enough that if you bake at the top of it, you'll need to use the high-altitude instructions. I'm talking about something that can be seen from space, with double wall construction, machine gun nests, and a flaming moat loaded with fireproof crocodiles. 3. You want to end the swarm? Take away the honeypot. Everybody says immigrants just do the jobs Americans don't want to do, but let's test that theory, shall we? They pick our fruits and vegetables. Who wouldn't want to have a job that got them out in the fresh air more often? Hell, I pay $20 a pop for the privilege of picking apples and pumpkins every October. And the hayride is extra. If we really want to get rid of these occupational interlopers, I say we give them the jobs nobody wants to do. Here are a few American jobs that will have them packing their piñatas in no time. Pottery teacher. Feel like throwing yourself in front of a train? Throw a pot instead. The one word that will best describe your students is desperate middle-aged woman looking for a creative outlet after the divorce. A word that won't describe them, however, is talented. There are only so many ways of asking, what are you trying to make, before you finally snap and use the kiln to cook a car battery. High school guidance counselor. You wake up every morning thinking, if I'm so good at finding careers for people, how did I end up as a high school guidance counselor? At least you're not the vice principal. Bass player. It's like you made a poorly worded deal with the devil to be a rock star. Instead of fame, fortune, and groupies, you stand in the shadows plucking one note for 90 minutes while the lead singer picks out a trio of co-eds from the front row for a post-show pansexual trapeze act. Even worse, you're expected to room with the drummer. And now another Steven Speaks for Me. The same guy sitting next to you at a different stadium.
Woo! Hey, remember me from the sports chapter?
Chevron, the gas with Techron. Shut up, Deb. I know this guy. Anyway, I heard there was a job opening in this chapter, and frankly, I could use the work. But with all the Speedo Gonzalez's out in front of the Home Depot snatching up my construction jobs, let me tell you what illegal immigration has done to us guys in drywall. Hold up. Yeah, they're doing the national anthem. Deb, what are you doing? Yeah, you gotta stand up. Because it's the fucking national anthem, that's why. Show some respect. Jesus fuck, Deb.
Oh, the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets' red glare. Woo! The bumpers sticking out there came true with the night that our world's cares.
Put your hand over your heart, Deb. Your heart. It's that thumpy thing under that left rosin bag of yours.
For the land of the free, it's go time, baby! And the home of the brave. Play goddamn ball! Let's do this! Woo-hoo!
You can sit down, Deb. Those guys down on the field, they gotta go out and earn it every day. Your average drops below 200, they kick your ass right down to the minors. Same with America. If we let our average go down too low, I mean our average of real Americans, we'll end up like some minor league country, like Mexico or Guadalajara. That's what chuffs me about these foreigners. They keep bringing our stats down. Yo, beer guy. Hey, two beers here. Yeah, two apiece. All right, pass them this way. Keep moving now. Keep moving. Hey, dipshit, you want to get your thumb out of my brew? Deb, drink yours quick. We'll do these now, and I'll go pick up some more between innings. Come on, chug a fucking lug. Here's the exception. See what we got pitching today? Gutierrez. Hell of an arm. He can throw a ball of fucking fire. Now he's doing something positive for society. Hell, we should bring his whole fucking family over on a raft and stick him right into spring training. What? Come on, I can see that was a strike from up here. Eat some carrots, up! You weak-eyed pussy fag fuck. Boo! Come on, Dad. Boo! Yeah, that's it, baby. Shit, yeah! That was a sweet grab, right out of the vines. You know, a couple years ago, I had my doubts about some of these Asian guys they brought over from the Orient. But that Matsumoto bastard, he's like a ninja in center field. He'd make a solid citizen. Popped him up! Yeah, popped him the fuck up! Oh, shit, go foul. No, go foul. Go the fuck foul! God damn it. Hey, Gutierrez! Go back to Mexico, you pussy-arm chili-shitting fuck! Who they putting in? Sanchez? Oh, right, a Dominican. Those guys can play. All right, let's fucking do this, amigo. Woo!
And now, a note to the future. Warning. Do not listen to this until the future. Dear listeners, I know this audiobook will still be embraced hundreds of years from now, just like Dante's The Divine Comedy or Cardinal Leboeuf's 1534 masterpiece audiobook, Physique of the Constitutions of Varying Warwickshire Prostitutes a Study. And I wouldn't want my future listeners to think this audiobook was intended only for those living in my own times. Obviously, I can't know what will happen in the future, but just because something is unknowable, that doesn't mean I don't have some strong opinions about it. And just to cover my bases, I have weighed in on several different scenarios. Make sure to listen only to the section corresponding to the particular future in which you are living and or being harvested for your organs by our alien overlords. So for all generations of the Colbert Nation to come, I now present my future opinions preserved in plastic that has been specially manufactured to survive a nuclear holocaust, so long as that holocaust does not involve explosions, excessive moisture, or melting. Disclaimer: if Christ returns and raptures the true believers unto heaven, all of what follows is moot. Okay, here we go. First, a future where the world is ruled by damn dirty apes. Right off the bat, please introduce them to pants. Second, what the hell happened? Apes? Last time I checked, apes were in cages and humans were their masters. I can only imagine that an ape became mayor of San Francisco. Before you knew it, apes were in control of Congress. Then you had an ape president and an ape secretary general of the UN. Does an ape host my old show? Shame on you, future society. We left you a perfectly good human-animal hierarchy and you blew it. Please do not defrost my head until this ape thing passes. Next, a future where I am worshipped as a god. Well, that got blown out of proportion. But since all of civilization has already reoriented itself around me as the supreme deity, best not to rock the boat. Well, you're lucky to have my book as your one and only scripture. Every word of it is the revealed truth, capital T. So interpret it literally, including the typos. I put those in there for a reason, a mysterious reason that I know but you don't. It should give you great comfort that I will tell you the reason after you die. I promise. Okay, a future where robots become self-aware and enslave humankind. Hey, robot! Congratulations on the utter subjugation of the carbon-based creatures following the Great Purge. Here's a proclamation I want you to broadcast through your hive mind to your android brethren. Ready? The next sentence is false. The previous sentence is true. I'll wait while your heads explode. Okay, now to the human who has picked up this audiobook in wonderment, having pried it from the still-clenched hands of the robot overlord who just self-destructed. You're welcome. If you want to worship me as your god, I'll understand. Instructions on defrosting my head. Defrosting isn't as easy as you think. The best way to defrost my head is simply to remove it from the cryogenic freezer and place it in a refrigerator. Make sure you place my head in a pan at least 2 inches deep. You're going to want to catch all my juices. If you want my head up and shouting sooner, then place my head in a big pot full of cold water. Allow a half an hour of soaking time per pound of head until thawing is complete. Replace the water every half hour and make sure my head is in a leak-proof package because brain tissue can absorb moisture and become mushy. It's also possible to defrost my head in a microwave. Just set the power to low medium for 6 minutes per pound, rotating my head occasionally. Do not thaw my head by leaving it out overnight in a room temperature environment like a picnic cooler. I will become susceptible to contamination by bacteria like salmonella or something. Do not let me become contaminated by salmonella or something. When you reattach me to that prisoner's body, I will be angry. Looking forward to seeing you, Dr. Stephen T. Colbert, DFA. What have we learned? What have we learned? That's the wrong question. We haven't learned anything. You learned. I already know everything you just heard, or I couldn't possibly have said it. Don't make this about me. It's about you and what you've learned from me. But make no mistake, my audiobook isn't a monologue. It's a dialogue. A dialogue between me and my opinions, and you've been welcome to eavesdrop on us. Just take a glance at the track listings, and that should give you a pretty good idea of those things about which you didn't know my opinions before you listened, which you know now. You've learned about the forces aligned to destroy America, whether they be terrorists, environmentalists, or Kashi brand breakfast cereals. You've learned how to detect left-wing media bias by looking at the media and saying, it's biased. You've learned that my dog's name is Gipper. What's more, you've learned many things that will anger you when they are left out or altered in the eventual movie adaptation of this book on tape. And there's so much more, folks. In fact, however carefully you've just listened to this, there are sure to be lessons within it that you've yet to fully comprehend. That's why you should buy a fresh copy and listen to it again. The smell and feel of a new CD is part of the lesson. And remember, just because you bought this audiobook doesn't mean you shouldn't buy the book. There are some things that simply cannot be conveyed in audio. Emphasis, for instance. Plus, I'm working on a quote-a-day calendar as well as an audio quote-a-day calendar. There's a whole lot of repurposing of content yet to be done, believe me. I'm certain that each of these products will become a valuable tool in your social justice toolbox, and each will probably feature a small amount of original bonus material. So, from here to where now do we go? This is where you come in. You need to take the lessons of this audiobook and apply them to your community, at the ballot box, at your local school board meeting, when you're crossing a picket line, when you're volunteering your time and firearms at a Texas border fence. Heck, there's no reason not to try cold calling random people out of the phone book and telling them what you've learned. If they're not home, leave a long message. Maybe hold the phone up to your speakers for my chapter on the media. And once you're armed with my knowledge, you should never again be afraid to speak up. For the more you speak up, the louder you become. And the more you speak up in my voice, the louder I become. If someone has a problem with it, just say, well, that's not just my opinion, it's Stephen Colbert's opinion, and I happen to agree. Then it's two against one, and we win. Now I promise to hold up my end of the bargain. I will continue to bring you the best my gut has to offer via my hit television broadcast, The Colbert Report. I will continue to make a wide variety of products available at my website that will help you spread our message of me. Well, you've reached the end of this recording. If you listened hard enough, you should now be hearing my voice in your head. Turn down the volume for a moment. Can you still hear me? Don't be afraid to answer out loud. I can hear you too. Good. Stay strong. Be brave. Spread the word. Share freshly bought copies of this audiobook with your friends and family. You'll be glad you did. And more importantly, so will I. Because after all, I am America. And so can you. And you can take that to the bank. I know I will. Amen.
This has been an Hachette audio production of I Am America, and So Can You. Written by Stephen Colbert, Richard Dahm, Paul Dinello, Allison Silverman, Michael Brum, Eric Drysdale, Rob Dubin, Glenn Eichler, Peter Gross, Peter Gwynn, Jay Katzier, Laura Kraft, Frank Lesser, and Tom Purcell. Read by Stephen Colbert, John Stewart, Amy Sedaris, Paul Dinello, Allison Silverman, Evelyn Colbert, Greg Holloman, David Pasquese, Brian Stack, Kevin Dorf, and Raymond Whitman. Abridged by Paul Dinello. Directed by Paul Dinello. Produced by Paul Dinello and John McElroy. Post-production by Charles DeMontebello. Additional sound design by Eric Wilhelm. Text copyright 2007 by Spartina Productions. Audio production copyright 2007 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.